special pleasure for me to come to Huntsville at the request of two organizations, the World Future Society and the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, both of which are voluntary associations of private individuals. The work that I will describe tonight was, until very recently, a very private individual effort. It began with the realization that in recent years, the world around us has been quietly going to pieces. Almost by chance, a few years ago, I began, initially as an exercise for students, to consider whether physics of a quite modest level might point the way to possible solutions of some general problems that face mankind. It seems awfully pretentious even to think in those terms, but I've found the numbers so compelling that I'm forced to ask that they be considered and studied by other people. The big long-term problems, as I think you know, are energy, materials, living space, and population. At this point, only 10% of the human population is intensively using energy, and yet already this year we hit the first energy shortage. We're going to hit more. If we count up total energy usage in the United States, we find that an astonishingly large fraction of our gross national product goes into energy, probably more than a third of our total budget. So a 30% rise in energy costs all by itself is enough to give us a 10% price rise averaged over the economy. And I'm sure you've noticed that we've had such a rise just within the past year. Price increases in crude oil imports alone are now costing us $30 billion a year in lost buying power compared to only 2 years ago. For the poor and hungry nations of the world, rising energy costs don't just mean poverty, they mean starvation, because modern high-yield agriculture requires a lot of energy. Material shortages are beginning to hit us also, and the withholding of materials is a weapon for both poor and rich nations which feel threatened, and we've seen this weapon starting to be used. Well, what sort of world is it going to be 25 to 45 years from now? Unless some new factor comes in which completely changes all the ground rules, even the most sober and reasoned projections indicate that it will be a world overcrowded and hungry, with poverty more widespread than it is today, a world more hostile as nations seek to gain or preserve by military threat diminishing supplies of food and materials. We've begun to see again that sort of threat starting to be applied. A world of stronger, more authoritarian governments, since only such governments can force the necessary sacrifices from their citizens. The United Nations Population Division says that even with a drastic and intensive and successful population control program in the underdeveloped nations, 25 years from now, there will be 6.5 billion people, simply because of the present age structure of the world population. In the year 2000, according to the United Nations, which is hardly an alarmist organization, the fraction of the world which is poor, much of it starving, will rise from its present value of about 70% to nearly 80%. There will then be more people in South and East Asia alone than there were in the whole world in 1970. In 2018, the UN estimates a world population between 8.5 and 9.5 billion. On the average, it's expected to be much poorer, hungrier, and more desperate than it is now. And remember, these are very conservative numbers on population increase. Some other critics would place it higher. Can we reverse this trend? Or, turning it another way, in positive terms, what should be our goals, both for humanitarian reasons and for our own self-interest? I don't think that we ought to be apologetic about trying to find goals which combine both of those properties. First, I believe, and this is a very personal list of the important goals, but first I would list ending hunger and poverty for all human beings. Second, finding high quality living space for a world population that will double in the next 35 years. Third, achieving population control without war or famine or dictatorship or any sort of coercion. And fourth, increasing individual freedom and the range of options available to every human being. I'll add a fifth goal, and speaking as an American, it's a very selfish one. finding a role for this country that can be of benefit to humanity as a whole, and at the same time can benefit our own people and our own economy. In the year 2000, only 25 years away, we will constitute only 4% of the world's population. As for how much wealth we will have to give away, I only ask you to look at the state of the economy right now and then wonder. So if we're going to do anything for the rest of the world as well as for ourselves, it's going to have to be by a trick of some kind. We've got to find something which uses the technology that we have. We can't just go giving money away. We don't have enough to give. Well, what would it take to achieve the goals that I've mentioned? First, it would take unlimited low-cost energy available to everyone. Second, unlimited living space of higher quality than perhaps 90% of the human race now has. Third, it would take an unlimited materials source available without stealing or killing or polluting. That's quite a tall set of orders. But what would we do if we had those things? What we could do would be first to supply cheap energy to the surface of the earth in the most environmentally acceptable way possible. The second would be to develop an alternative site for industry in space, where the growth in productivity, which is the basis for what wealth we have, could go on unchecked. Ultimately, when that industry is able to produce at lower cost than its competition on Earth, the normal forces of the marketplace ought to come into play, and substantial emigration should go on as people seek higher paying jobs and better living conditions in what would be, really, space habitats or space colonies. Well, that sounds pretty far out. So, to defend my sanity, I'd like to add that I didn't take these space colonization ideas seriously until a number of technical points became clear. First, a design exists for a habitat more attractive than most of the Earth and a lot better able to support industry without damage. Second, energy costs there ought to be competitive even from the start and should eventually go down to something like a fraction of a cent per kilowatt hour. Third, the materials resources available in space are so great that, just for example, the three largest asteroids alone could allow our building space colonies with a total land area more than 1,000 times that of the Earth. Last and most important, we already have the technology needed to do the job. We don't need any new breakthroughs if we use what we already know and use it properly. We don't require, for example, anything as far out as hydrogen fusion power, just to use an example. Now, given that approach, within the next century, we could, I believe, free every human being from hunger and poverty, and we would then still have more than 1,000 years to adjust to an eventual slow growth rate. Clearly, mankind cannot go on exponentially increasing in numbers indefinitely. There has to be a slowdown and an eventual near stop. The difference is that if we go as we are now, the crunch is coming on a time scale of a decade, and at a time when 70% of the world's population is so desperately poor that it cannot take part in any kind of a dialogue as to what should be done. In contrast, if we follow the line which I will project for you tonight, I believe there is the possibility for having at least 1,000 years of growth under conditions of great wealth for everyone in the human race, during which there should be plenty of time to discuss how growth is to be reduced. Now, to estimate conservatively what sort of habitat might be practical in the long term, and when I say long term, I mean only 50 to 100 years from now, I'll sketch a space colony which is about as big as may be practical using present-day materials. I think it must be clear to you the fundamental problem is, unless you can build something in space which is attractive, that people will want to move to, will choose to move to, no one's going to move. So we have to start out by saying that in the long term, we're looking towards something which could be attractive. So let me again remind you, I'm not talking about next year or even next decade in the first pictures that I will show, but I'm talking about something that should be realizable within a time scale of roughly 50 to 100 years. So the first slide shows a view of what we call for convenience a Model 4 large-size space colony. I think we'll have to arrange to get the lights off at some point. The cylinder is rotating. Its axis is pointing straight out of the screen toward us, rotating once every 2 minutes so that anyone who is standing on the inside experiences one normal Earth gravity. The cylinder is divided into 6 segments, 3 valley areas about 2 miles wide, and 3 window areas, which are subdivided into small panels and which are also about 2 miles wide. And there is natural sunshine coming in through these windows, going through the 4 miles of atmosphere and falling on the land area on the other side. Now, for scale, here is any one of the big bridges, or here's the Empire State Building. Your first view of that makes you think, my gosh, this is very much bigger than anything that's been built on the Earth, and therefore it must be terribly hard or impossible to build. But after living with this sort of concept for a few years, my feeling is rather, it's so much easier to build things in zero gravity in space that it was really impressive that these old timers managed to build something as big as that on the ground. Now, the next slide shows a picture of the end cap, which closes off a cylinder of that kind and makes it a complete pressure vessel holding an atmosphere. So here is the axis of the cylinder, the axis of rotation, and the land area, the valley that I spoke about just now, is down here. The buildings, of course, are far too small to be seen on this scale, and a normal cloud base with reasonable relative humidity would be something around 3,000 feet, which shows like this. So the center line of the cylinder is 3 times as high as the clouds. I remind you that this is completely in terms of materials which do exist at the present time. This does not mean using anything that's beyond the limits of present day known technology in terms of strength of materials. Now, the ends of this cylinder, which might be 15 or 20 miles long, the ends of this cylinder have to be closed off by hemispherical end caps. And since they have to be there anyway, it seems reasonable to put mountains on them. And my own prejudices show, because I happen to have used in this a tracing of an air view of the Grand Tetons in Wyoming. These mountains would be rather fun to climb, by the way. Just notice that as you start climbing up these mountains and you get to about the 5,000 foot level, you start to get rather tired. It's okay because your weight has dropped to half what it was when you started. And in fact, as you continue up here, by the time you get to the top, you'll weigh nothing at all and can even take off in man-powered flight with a flying machine if you choose to. There's also another reason why climbing these mountains might be rather fun, because when you get to the top, to the 10,000 foot level, the atmospheric pressure has dropped only about half as much as it would on Earth going up the same amount. It's only dropped to about the 5,000 foot level. The next slide is a sort of a nuts and bolts schematic. It shows the side view of one of these large habitats as seen from a distance in space, and I'll just go down through the elements that go into it. First of all, solar power. This cylinder is rotating with its axis always pointing toward the sun. That's important because the colony runs entirely on solar energy. The amount of power that would be available in the solar stations up here is so great that we could be talking about a really high energy economy, not just what the American people use at the present time and may not be able to use a year or two from now, but perhaps as much as 10 or 20 times the per capita electric power, which is now customary in the United States. The geometry is so arranged that there are external mirrors, planar mirrors of this kind, which rotate with the habitat so that, if you think about it for a moment, you realize that a person who is standing on the land area in any of these valleys, looking up and seeing the disk of the sun, sees the disk of the sun stationary in the sky, even though the habitat is rotating once every 2 minutes. Now, there is an additional degree of freedom which goes with that, of course, which is that the mirror angle can be changed so that one can even make the disk of the sun rise to form a sunrise and move across the sky during the day and fall at sunset. Given that, one also has control over the length of day and therefore the climate and the seasons. Now, the fundamental idea in a space habitat of this sort is that the human functions of living and of industry and of agriculture should be separate and non-interfering with each other, but close together for convenience. And that's arranged in the following way. First of all, practically all of the industry involved would be in zero gravity, but quite close by, outside the colony. Something, for example, which is using a tremendous amount of power so that it has to radiate power away into space would be located a few kilometers away from the habitat so that it wouldn't be producing any heating in the habitat itself. How about agriculture? Well, that too would be carried out outside the main living colony. It would be done in these agricultural cylinders, one of which is shown here. In an end view, these agricultural cylinders form a ring, a non-rotating ring, going all the way around the habitat itself. Individually, the cylinders would rotate. Now, given agriculture carried out this way, let's think about some of the possibilities. First of all, this agriculture would be started with sterile soil and with carefully inspected seeds from the earth, and seeded only with those bacteria which are necessary for plant growth. Therefore, there would be no need ever to use insecticides or pesticides, because you would just not introduce from the start the agricultural pests which have taken hundreds of thousands of years to evolve on the surface of the earth. By the same token, in the main living habitat, you would introduce a complete ecology, but I think that there are a few free riders that you could leave back, and among them I would list mosquitoes, rats, houseflies perhaps, I don't know. Okay, given agriculture of that kind, with individual control over the length of the day in each one, and therefore the average temperature, one also has control over the seasons. In the agricultural cylinders, they could even run January, February, March, April, May, and so on as you go around, so that it would be possible to have all food fresh. There would be no need to have anything canned or frozen, and you could imagine having fresh strawberries 12 months of the year if you want to. The distance, of course, from the growing location to the place where the food is consumed is only about 20 miles or so, so that things can be fresh. Now, as for travel over long distances, perhaps the easiest way would be simply to have a launch track which is pointing in a pre-computed direction. One has an electric motor and a cable, and accelerates a vehicle which has no onboard crew and no engines up to a speed of perhaps 1,000 or 2,000 miles per hour. It then moves in free flight over a distance which could be thousands of miles until it's stopped by an arresting cable at another colony that far away. So that sort of flight ought to be of very low cost. Now, this object up here in the sky constitutes a big gyroscope. I pointed out that the geometry requires that the sunshine always be coming along the cylinder axis. The problem of the gyroscope means, as all good physicists know, that that gyroscope has got to be precessed, because we're assuming that that colony is moving with the Earth and the Moon in its annual tour around the Sun. So that spin axis has got to be moved, precessed, through a full 360 degrees in a whole year. The easiest way to do that, in a way which does not cost any energy, is simply to build another identical habitat of the same kind, a distance below this center line that would constitute being, about here. So imagine another cylinder down here, as seen from the upper picture. That cylinder is now linked to the first one by a very lightweight linkage at each end with bearings, which are not shown here. Once you have that arrangement, which provides the, what physicists call torque, which does the precession of the gyroscopic angular momentum. I shouldn't use these physics terms, but that's what's going on. Once you've done that, there are some nice things that come for free. One of them is that you now have independence of the climate and season in these two habitats, and you have the possibility of what I like to call seasonal counterpoint. You could have a New England January in one of them, while there's June in the other. And given that possibility, you immediately ask, how can I go from one to the other for a weekend? Well, there's a very easy way. If you simply get in a small vehicle which is locked onto the outside of one cylinder and therefore moving with its own tangential velocity, which is about 400 miles per hour, if the vehicle is unlocked at a pre-computed time, it will move in free flight at that tangential velocity, and in about 8 minutes, it can lock on to the outside of the other cylinder. It's a transfer which has cost no energy at all. It sounds a bit like perpetual motion, but it really isn't. It doesn't violate any laws of physics. It's a way in which, using a vehicle with no engines and no onboard crew, in 8 minutes you can make a trip from January to June. Or, if you prefer, of course, I assume that the people who settle a colony of that kind will probably choose to go to the places that have seasons and climates of the kinds that they like. We already see that sort of effect on Earth. And one thing that they might do is to arrange a nice, severe, New England-type climate in one of these habitats, and something like Hawaii in the other. Now, a colony would be big enough to model some of the most desirable areas of the Earth. I'll just show that by one or two slides, if I could have the next one, please. The two intervening slides, which we may get to in a moment, one of the valley areas in a space cock. That happens to be Carmel, California. A nice crowded place. It would be nice to have a few others of them. That's Carmel, shown all the way from Pebble Beach at one end down to Point Lobos at the other end. It fits very nicely within a few miles length of one space colony valley. The point of this, of course, is simply to say that places which people find very desirable in the Earth are actually of quite modest scale for the most part, modest enough to go into a space colony quite comfortably. I don't think we are at the Grand Canyon stage yet. Wait a couple of centuries, please, for that. Okay, now, let's see what slide comes next and then I'll decide what to say. Okay, let's hold with that one, please. Now, I've talked about colonies of that kind not at all with the thought that they are what we would start out building, but rather to indicate that in the long run, it's possible within the limits of present-day technology and materials to build something which is big enough to be interesting and attractive. Let's now go to the other extreme. Start with something which we could imagine building ourselves. And I'm talking about a time scale that's not very far away. Perhaps too ambitious, maybe not. We'll see. The picture which is shown here is the so-called Model 1, or sometimes we call it Island 1, thinking of these as islands in space. This is a small version of the large habitat which I showed before, but basically the same design. It's a cylinder about 1,000 meters long, perhaps 200 meters in diameter, and with the same arrangement of mirrors, a very big solar power station because of the fact that it would be basically a space manufacturing facility with very effective high-pressure industry going on there. The linkage from one habitat to the other is by a very lightweight structure at this end, possibly the same sort or a cable at the other end. And to give you a feeling for the numbers involved, in order to provide the precession forces that are required in order that axis always points toward the sun, one requires forces of only about 60 pounds in this linkage compression tower. Now, it's my belief, and that's the thing which we're now beginning to study, that we should be able to build a colony of that size, something which could support of the order of 10,000 people in less than 15 years and for something of the order of magnitude of the cost of the Apollo project. The next picture will show something which is for scale only, not for detail. This is a very unimaginative view of the end cap of Island 1. Very unimaginative because I just drew it up myself. Now, fortunately, there are six or eight architectural groups that have started to study the possibilities of Island 1, and they will presumably be coming up with much more attractive city plans for a colony of that kind. But this shows apartments down in this region here. The apartments could be, for example, 2,000 square feet for a family of five and with several hundred square feet of garden. It would be a very nice garden. Of course, it's one in which you don't ever have to use agricultural sprays, and it's one where you could go out and take a sun bath without ever being bitten by a mosquito. But going up a little bit, there would be offices and light industry, probably a park. Of course, if you look up from the park, if you're lying under a tree, you'd look up here and you'd see another tree growing down toward you. But then you're not trying to fool people and try to tell them they're still on the Earth. It really is different. There are some things that would be rather fun, even in the comparatively small scale of Model 1. And one of these is, besides the possibilities of man-powered flight in this region, that one could have a swimming pool at low gravity. And there are those of us who have become a little creaky in the joints with the passage of age could still dive, and we'd have several seconds to rearrange our limbs in the correct way before we had to enter the water. And when we do so, of course, the water, the waves will come up in slow motion around us. And of course, all the rough stuff, anything nasty or dirty like industry, would all be located out here in zero G, where it's easier to do anyway. Now, a small colony like that is going to need careful design with spot shielding for cosmic ray protection. It may run in a mainly oxygen atmosphere for economy. For two other views, a London newspaper a few months ago commissioned the next view of Island 1 at the what's called the L5 Earth-Moon Lagrange Libration Point. Can we see the next slide, please? This was done by an English artist named David Hardy, and it shows the two cylinders of Island 1 tied together, used poetic license. This is actually much closer together than they could be in real life, but never mind that. Also, rather unimaginatively, he gave them numbers, whereas, of course, any community of 10,000 people is going to have a name, not a number. He did, however, show over here the moon, and this illustrates an important point. The sun, of course, is down to the lower left on this picture. The location of the colony might be in an orbit around what's called the Lagrange point, L5. And all that means is that it's simply the third point on an equilateral triangle where the other two points are the Earth and the Moon. Happens to be a stable solution to the gravitational problem. The next slide after this is a painting by an artist named Walter Zawoyski. Happened to be used on the cover of Physics Today a few months ago and also on the covers of some other magazines. And it's very mysterious and spacey. Walter didn't want to put in any of the ugly realities of all of the industry that would be on the outside here or anything of that kind. But I think he had the right idea. He put in almost no detail, and then we're free to treat this like a coloring book and put in the things that we think we need. Now, I want to draw a contrast by the following comparison. You all know of something which is called Project Independence, and which is supposed to make us 75% of foreign energy sources by the year 1985. Its friends say that it will cost about $600 billion in capital. Its opponents say that it may cost $2,000 billion in capital. Of course, it will permanently increase our annual energy costs because of the fact that it optimizes a political rather than an economic quality factor. It will also run through our fossil fuel reserves at an accelerating rate, since it's using up our energy rather than somebody else's. Now, in contrast to that, space colonization should cost, I believe, a great deal less. I would estimate 1/20th as much. Even what I consider are quite conservative estimates, very initial estimates that have been made by some good friends at NASA, indicate that it would be still a great deal less than the lowest estimate that's been put on the price of Project Independence. And I believe it would give low-cost energy forever, both in space and here on the Earth. So now I'll really get into the nuts and bolts and talk to you about how we might go about it. The next slide shows a mass budget for Model 1. Okay, this mass budget is divided into two columns. The left is the total mass that's required for each component of the habitat, and the right is the mass which is required from the Earth. And this is the key to the whole question, because even to have any hope of making the thing go at a reasonable cost, it's got to be a bootstrap operation. It's got to be something where you put up a minimum mass from the surface of the Earth and somehow get almost all of the mass for the colony from somewhere else. And the somewhere else at the beginning is the surface of the Moon. Now, the left-hand column then gives us the aluminum for the structure. We would say 20 to 100,000 tons of aluminum, depending on a number of factors. Glass for the windows, 10 or 20,000 tons. Water, at a budget of 5 tons of water per person, that's 50,000 tons of water. We can't afford to take all that water from the surface of the Earth, and we don't have to, because the lunar surface is about 40% oxygen by weight, and water is 89% oxygen by weight. So if we have a cheap method of getting material from the surface of the Moon out to L5, it makes a lot better sense just to carry up liquid hydrogen from the surface of the Earth, and that's over here, budgeted as 5,400 tons, mass required from the Earth, and to combine it at L5 with oxygen, which is going to come out as a byproduct of the industrial processing there anyway. Now, we have to start with some things that do have to be brought from the Earth. First is a generator plant, which is 1,000 tons, that's a 100 megawatt plant, of which about 40 megawatts has to go into making aluminum. The initial structures, there has to be something equivalent to a space station to house the initial construction workforce and the chemical processes which have to be there. That's budgeted at 1,000 tons. Then there will be a lot of small-scale hardware which it doesn't make sense to try to build at the construction site. Anything made of plastic would have to come from the Earth. Anything which is light in mass but complex and labor-intensive, it would make more sense to bring from the Earth in the beginning. That's budgeted here at 1,000 tons. Machines and tools at another 800. And then a great deal of just soil and rock and construction materials, over 400,000 tons, is here. Then such things as people and equipment, a food base, that food base of 600 tons, think of mainly as a way to start intensive agriculture. I don't think anybody wants to live on dehydrated food for several years. Now, for economy, we have to get about 98% of that mass from the surface of the moon. We need some kind of a materials launcher which has a very high ratio of throughput to its own mass.